Hello and welcome to another episode of Cloud Security Podcast. This is the last episode for the Cloud Security Trends Month, and we are talking about Zero Trust. Yes, we are talking about how do we build applications with a Zero Trust principle. For this, we had Max Burkhardt from Figma. He recently gave a talk at Forward CloudSec about this very topic, and I did not want to miss an opportunity to bring him on board and share that same thing with you guys. During the episode, we spoke about Zero Trust as a principle. What does that mean? And specifically in an application context, we also spoke about how does Zero Trust kind of change the way we do defense for applications, whether it makes it harder, easier, and how does it really fit into our DevOps pipeline with Zero Trust? So all that and a lot more. I'll let you enjoy the episode. And I just want to say thank you to everyone who's left us a review or a rating over the last week. It really means us a lot. And it also really means a lot to the guests as well who come in and spare their time for everyone else over here to kind of learn from them. And if you haven't given a review or rating on iTunes or whatever platform that you hear this on, I would really appreciate if you kind of consider doing a review or a rating. It really helps us get discovered by more people like yourself who can find value from this. And as I said, this is the last episode for this month of Cloud Security Trends. Next month, we're going to talk about serverless. And I'm really excited to kind of share some of the guests that are going to come on board. I hope you enjoy this episode. And I do have a free giveaway, which would be announced on to the social media channel. So make sure you follow us there as well, so you get to know when the free giveaway is announced. I would really look forward to giving you guys back something as a thank you from our side for supporting us for over 100 episodes and also helping us reach the 100K target before we ended the season. So thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed the episode and I'll talk to you soon. Peace. Time is the enemy of security, and that's where Exonius comes in. Exonius helps organizations immediately know what assets they have and shows which devices, cloud instances, and users adhere to or deviate from security policies. Learn more and try it for free at exonius.com. How do you get your cloud security news without scouring the internet for hours? I normally just head to Cloud Security News to get my weekly update on what's most popular in the cloud security world. If you are interested in this, check out Cloud Security News on all popular podcast platforms or on www.cloudsecuritypodcast.tv. Hey.
Absolutely. It's great to be here.
Oh, man. I think it's really interesting to kind of bring people who have known me from before, or at least with the beard, but I appreciate you coming on board and
Absolutely.
Thank you for coming.
See the new visual rework.
Actually, that's a good way to put it. I'm going to tell my wife about this. Like, have you noticed a new visual?
21, yeah.
Yeah, this is my 2021. So, Max, for people who probably don't know you, and I'm curious if you can tell us a bit about yourself and your journey into cybersecurity.
Yeah, absolutely. So, my name is Max. I'm a security engineer working in San Francisco. I sort of grew up in the Bay Area, California area, and have worked here sort of my whole life. Security for me started as a passion that was very early. Somewhere around middle or high school, I started learning about this as I was kind of getting into tech, and fortunately had a few opportunities that allowed me to really dive into that more deeply, mostly actually through working in sort of IT roles in various schools along the way. So I did some IT support at my high school. I did some IT support at my university and was able to kind of always have an eye towards like, oh, what's the secure way to do this? Or how do I learn about how to compromise this server that I just set up, and started basically learning things from there. I kind of transitioned that into starting a cybersecurity competition team at UC Berkeley, which was a really fun time. We can talk about that if you want. But basically, it was just always trying to learn more about this. I think the sort of puzzle aspects of information security are really, really just that sort of satisfaction of understanding how an exploit works or how to defend a system is something that is super thrilling to me. And so then I was able to fortunately carry that through into a career, first in pen testing and then now in various application defense.
All right. Oh, so you were in like on the pen testing consulting side and then you moved toward the company side.
Yeah. So yeah, basically when I graduated university, well, there were kind of two things going on. One is that I knew that consulting would give you a really good variety of the company I worked for. I was doing projects that were 2 to 4 weeks in length. And each time you'd hop between those projects, you could have a radically different tech stack or target or like kind of goal in mind in your assessment. And so that was really great. And I knew that would be good for learning, is that 1 week I would be doing OAuth 2 web application security stuff. And the next week I might be trying to like write a fuzzer for some sort of binary protocol. So that was neat. But then the other aspect, which I'm not going to lie about, is that I wanted to definitely officially be a hacker. And I knew that if I kind of went into the offensive side of things for a little bit, I knew that I would get the experience and space to learn this. And so that was kind of what led me there. But over the last 6 years or so, I have moved into the defensive side because honestly, it's a little harder and I think also a bit more rewarding.
That's awesome, man. I think we can definitely do with a lot more skilled people like yourself on the defensive side as well. So thanks for coming on the other side, jumping from the dark. But now on the topic, the zero trust principles, it's a term which has different definition for a lot of people. And I'm curious, what does zero trust mean for you? Maybe let's just go with that.
Yeah. First off, like, I know that this term has sort of become, there's a lot of hype around it. It's become a buzzword. I don't really know when that happened. It seems like it was kind of recently. I know that like NIST, one of the United States, like a standards agency, has some official terms for this. But just sort of personally, the way that I have thought about it, well, the easiest, quickest thing, which is not entirely correct, is no VPN. Right. That would be my fastest way to say what is zero trust is get rid of the VPN. But more accurately, I think the way that I see zero trust is it's a philosophy of trying to make it so that individual components of a system, whether they be web applications or servers, something like that, are sort of given more context with which to make authentication decisions. And so when a user shows up at the door of a web application or an SSH server, instead of just having maybe like a single username and password or a single SSH key to sort of authenticate that user, that system gets a little more context, like, where is this user coming from? Have I seen this IP address before? Is this a device that's managed by the company I'm owned by? Has there been some sort of multi-factor authentication? There's all these additional signals that we're now making accessible to the underlying backend applications that lets them be much smarter about whether or not to allow access to something. And so this really lets us raise the bar in terms of defense because it's much harder to fake all of those requirements or slip past all those defenses if you have to do it for every single system you're trying to connect to, right? Well, we've known it's been not a great architecture for a long time, but this concept of sort of a hard shell and soft center is pretty pervasive in a lot of networks. And I think Zero Trust is really just sort of a rebranding of the decades-long effort that's been going on in InfoSec to try and make it a hard shell and a hard...
Yep. I can definitely say that. We just put a different lipstick on it, I guess, for lack of a better word. So maybe let's just put it this way. I guess we would have a lot of people who are thinking about it from an application perspective, but they would not have thought about zero trust in an application. Mm-hmm. So maybe a good place to start would be, what are some of the building blocks for, say, to your point, no VPN kind of access to an application?
Yeah. So this is a point where I think that application security and infrastructure security really blend together. And I mean, this is a cloud security podcast. And so I think if you talk to a lot of cloud security practitioners, they'll agree that, yes, it's infrastructure security, but there's a lot of application stuff that's going on as well, right? Like, I primarily work with AWS at my day job, and I'm technically working on infrastructure, but all I'm doing is making REST API calls on systems that are making other REST API calls with each other, right? So It feels a lot like AppSec in a lot of ways. And so basically, what are the building blocks? So you need some sort of interface that can sort of surround your application and A, give you confidence to put it on the internet and give you some authentication hooks that will allow you to integrate with like a broader authentication scheme. The first point about like giving you confidence to put it on the internet, right? Like, you are probably not going to go put your plain Node.js like default web server directly exposed to the wild internet. You could try, it might be fine, but that's probably not an architecture I would pursue. So you'll want something where you have confidence in like, oh, I can patch this, or my cloud security provider can patch it. Actually, that's the one that we generally recommend, is like, let Amazon handle the patching if possible. You want something there that's going to be able to receive your requests and then sort of perform other actions. But then authentication is really this key part of the zero trust system, is right. There's zero trust at the beginning of the conversation, but theoretically, when a user establishes a session, like, they will have proven that they are trustworthy via some sort of authentication. And so here is where you can hook into a lot of modern authentication capabilities that give you this sort of stronger insight about who is connecting under what circumstances. So a good example, which is what we used in the blog post I wrote that I think sort of started this whole conversation, is we have a variety of applications that we want to sort of behave in this zero trust manner. They are on the internet via AWS application load balancers. That's a HTTP front end to the internet that Amazon patches and keeps secure for us, and we can like configure it to be do what we want. And then that is able to provide authentication hooks to our single sign-on provider. And so that's another kind of key point about all of this. A lot of zero trust, as I see it, is about sort of distributing the load of authentication. It's about making it so that individual applications can make those good security decisions. But at the same time, as a security team, you want to be able to have some sort of single point of visibility. And that's where single sign-on can become really powerful.
Right. So you're saying building blocks would be primarily authentication based, or are there, like I said, so obviously there's a component that you mentioned, which they use the products which are provided by a cloud service provider, so they don't have to patch or like maintain anything. Then the other component is authentication. Are there other pieces around it, or nothing to your point? Because I feel like application probably has a lot more, but that kind of covers most of the perspective.
Yeah. So moving on, like it's kind of hard to draw exactly where the lines of these building blocks are, but I think another key thing after you've gotten So you have some sort of system that can authenticate a user. That system needs to be able to present information securely and reliably to the application about who this user is. It is tempting to try and write these sort of wrappers around apps that do all the authentication and just like pass the user's traffic into the application, say like, here, we promise it's secure. But really, at that point, you've sort of like re-implemented a VPN. And so I think this is where you really get into the application security side of things, is if you have a system that can authenticate a user, maybe create some sort of cryptographically signed token saying who they are or what they should be allowed to do or what groups they're in, then your application can then do authorization logic or access control logic on that information that it was able to get from sort of your zero trust layer. And access control is a really hard problem. The amount of complexity that you quickly end up in as soon as you try and build one of these things is very significant. But a core piece of that is making sure that your authentication layer can effectively and efficiently say, like, we're sure this is this user, and here's some additional context about them so that you can make access control decisions.
Oh, so would you say zero trust kind of is also continuous authentication as well then? I mean, but continuous authentication, which is seamless to the end user. They don't realize that, hey, I'm being asked for MFA every time I send a request, but it's consistently validating, hey, this is logging in. Hey, this is a sheet.
I think that's what you should be shooting for, right? And there's a lot of fun attacks to think about how you might be able to get around that. So one of the things that I certainly think about is like, as a pen tester, it's a very profitable exercise to compromise someone's machine, take their cookies, and then browse the web as them, right? It's a great 2FA bypass, where somebody may have signed in with 2FA at one point, but then they get a session cookie, like authenticates the session for the next 8 hours or whatever. And if an attacker can get access to that, then they're off to the races. And so it's interesting to think about how you can use some of these sort of more modern authentication mechanisms to try and avoid that sort of thing. So a good example might be, if you are doing some sort of mutual TLS as well, a regular web session, or you're like periodically sending the user to like a sort of invisible redirect MTLS page in order to kind of go through that auth, that might allow you to detect a stolen cookie or defeat that attack, because even if an attacker has access to a cookie, they may not necessarily have access to like a cert that would identify them as that device. So continuous authentication is an interesting one because performance matters, right? And any security team that tries to go say like, for every request, you must like put in username, password, MFA, and use the cert and stuff like that, like you're probably going to be assigned to a new project or something. So that's not going to work. But I think there's ways that you can fit in some of those things by focusing on the user experience of authentication in the first place. You can make sure that like re-authentication is pretty easy. So a huge one for us is that WebAuthn is such a nicer mode of multi-factor authentication than the old like text you a code or code generator ones was, right? Like we're fortunate to have a employee base that's mostly, and the fact is that people can just go to their web application and then touch their fingerprint to touch ID and it'll do a WebAuthn multi-factor. And it's like a really beautiful and smooth user experience. And so people don't complain about multi-factor nearly as much as they used to, and they had to go like dig out their phone and like figure out what code to put in and stuff like that.
Because I always find that this MFA use should be a thing because it needs to be a separate device. But nowadays you have YubiKeys. You can just plug that into your MacBook or Windows laptop or whatever. But that kind of helps you bypass, as long as that's connected in, you don't need 2FA kind of a thing as well. I'm sure that people can use that and reduce the annoyance.
Yeah, that's a good point about like the multiple devices thing, because I think that has been a confusing factor throughout the rollout of MFA. I think the way that I look at it, dividing like this device must be physically separate from this one is maybe not the most useful mechanism for thinking about that attack. It's more like, what levels of access might give you access to someone's machine or their session or the password, but not necessarily the device. And so with a lot of the WebAuthn authenticators, the thing that you're kind of checking for is physical presence. And there are many attacks where an attacker gains some sort of digital presence on someone's machine, but not any sort of physical one. And so that tends to be a pretty powerful differentiator there.
Yeah, actually, that's interesting, because they're almost like, even from an authentication perspective and thinking about zero trust, we have the trust that we have on the device itself, that, hey, this is a sheesh logging in from a company lab. And then there's the other layer after that is, this is actually a sheesh, because he has the 2FA or YubiKey or whatever. And then the layer after that, another layer is, hey, can he access facebook.com for, like, I'm just going to think, or whatever they call meta.com now, whatever they call now. So if you can go to the metaverse, if he has the authentication, so there's almost like three layers of authentication, just like, so to your point about the access control thing, it does get quite complicated when the number of applications or the number of metaverses, I don't know, 10, 20, 15, right? Because depending on SaaS application stuff as well. So yeah. What are your thoughts on, like, those kind of things? Does that get complicated or is that just simplified?
It can. I think that an important design decision as you're thinking about building this sort of system is, like, what sort of things do we want to handle centrally and what sort of things do we want to farm out to the applications themselves? So for instance, in our configuration, we can sort of say centrally, like, here's the conditions in which we want to require multi-factor authentication, right? And so we don't need every application developer who's working on an internal app to do this or that to think about what the multi-factor requirements are. Like, that information is available to them if they want to do something based on it. But centrally, we can confirm that everyone who's accessing something used a multi-factor key in order to get access to that sort of thing. And so that's a place where we're doing some sort of central control to give us that sort of guarantee. But still, that information is available to the backends if they wish for it. There are other cases where you might want to delegate more. So for instance, let's say, I'm trying to think of a good example, you could potentially do something where you have an application that wants to show some information, wants to allow login for mobile devices and laptops, for instance, but might want to not display all of the information on mobile. So maybe there's certain information that's too sensitive for mobile devices because those are more easily lost or stuff like that. And so that would be an interesting case where it's like, well, the central system will let login happen under any circumstances, but it needs to give some sort of signal to the backend of, like, this was a device that is guaranteed to be a laptop. And, like, we know that this is a company machine and therefore it's okay to show them more information, but then, or other cases, like, it might not be. And so in that case, really, you're kind of delegating to the backend system because it's a sort of a unique use case for that.
Interesting. Actually, and it's kind of, my next question is kind of what we thought about over here as well. So just trying to quickly go through the comments. Hey, good day to all IO. And the question from Vineet is there a standard or guidance practice which devs can follow with zero trust principles?
Yeah, so I mentioned that there's a NIST technical document about zero trust that I found to be a pretty well-written one. It is a little dry because it's a standards technical document, but I think it kind of gives a good view of a lot of these things without a lot of vendor hype, which I think is kind of the problem with a lot of trying to learn about zero trust is that you Google it and you find a lot of vendors who are selling you various zero trust things. It's kind of being used more in a buzzword context. So I think that's a good place to start. But also, I think there's a lot of conversations like this one happening in the internet and YouTube and podcasts and stuff. And so hearing people's takes on and trying to think about that philosophy of, like, how do we distribute this authentication context and how do we make it so that individual apps are empowered to make good authentic decisions is really where you want.
Yeah, awesome. And hopefully that answers your question, Vinny. Because I've always been curious about the misinformation that's there with zero trust as well. You know, I think you and I have just touched on the fact that, hey, there's device and there is the user itself, 2FA and all that. But you almost kind of go, well, is that enough? Because technically zero trust, like, how you're trusting the authentication device, but it's kind of like the space, what do you trust? Like, you kind of eventually have to trust something.
That's right. And that is where you have to think about sort of the possibilities for attacks and what your threat model is, right? So, like, something that I've mentioned a few times is this, like, concept of device trust. The way that a lot of vendors that I've seen implement device trust is you have some sort of, like, agent that's running on the machine that's supposed to verify certain things. And that will provide certificates to that machine that are, like, signed through some sort of central authority on some schedule. And then if you can present one of those certificates, you're considered to be a trusted machine. And so the theory there is that if you get one of those certificates, then you must have this agent running, and therefore the agent must think that your machine is compliant. And we all know that's not entirely true, right? Like, certs can be stolen. You can access things in keychain access if you can convince a user to, like, type in their password at one point. And, like, there's all sorts of tricks that a red teamer or an actual attacker might be able to use to get one of those certificates. But at the same time, that is a level that gives you something, right? Like, if somebody steals a phone that never was device trusted, like, even if they can steal sessions off that, they're never going to be able to log into an application that, like, required that certificate off it. So you have to think about, for each of these controls, like, there's going to be some sort of case in which an attacker can subvert it, right? Like, YubiKeys can be stolen. Like, sometimes the attacker does have physical access. And so it's important to think about those things. But it's also important to remember that most of the time, the things that are getting people compromised are phishing and password reuse across multiple cloud providers, right? And so there are a few techniques that are going to be really effective against those things that appear to be the major drivers in breaches.
Yeah, and I think in a way, it's good that you've got the pen testing background as well, because you can kind of talk about the attacking side of things as well, how someone misuse it. And I've got another question here from, so we have answered the question from Vinny, thank you. I've got a question from Io as well. How does zero trust principles fit into a DevOps pipe?
That's a good question. I would say that a lot of this concept of zero trust being about like letting applications make their own security decisions actually fits very well into the DevSecOps philosophy of make the people who are writing the code also responsible for deploying and securing that code, right? So if you are thinking about like sort of your ideal DevOps engineer, they build an application. They want to make it resilient so it doesn't go down, so they don't get paged at night. They want to make it secure so they don't end up in like security incident review because their data got leaked and stuff like that. And Zero Trust can give that ideal engineer sort of the information they need in order to make their product really secure, right? Like in a sort of earlier world where you think about like, we just have a bunch of applications that are running on this internal network, right? Like an application developer has very little context to say like, oh, I can make sure that no attackers connect to my service. Because all they know is like who has an internal IP address, right? That's not a very solid basis to make an authentication decision on. So I think it is philosophically aligned. In terms of technical things, like maybe I don't think there's necessarily a strong link there. The tools that you would use to build a zero trust thing fit into a DevOps pipeline, but also can work with other sort of development methodologies. But I think that the idea behind both of them is very similar. It's like push that sort of information down to the edge so that individual components can be resilient and secure.
Just an interesting point as well. And I'll be keen to know your thoughts as well on this, because it's such a trust, the keyword being trust there. As an organization, you may choose not to completely trust your DevOps pipeline, or you may choose to go, oh, as long as it's on the pipeline, I trust it. Like, I wonder if there's that, because to your point about the philosophic, as an organization, we could just trust that fact that, yeah, they know what they're doing. Max sounds like a smart person. Io sounds like a smart person. When they combine and make a DevOps pipeline with zero trust, I'm going to trust it. I think that's how probably a lot of people would take it.
That's a good point, actually. And like attacking CI systems has been one of my favorite things. It's something I think a lot about, because fundamentally, I think this doesn't always get enough time. Maybe it is more now. Like I've seen some cool blog posts about it. But a CI system is literally a remote code execution as a service. Right? Like its whole job is to take this blob of data, some of which is new and changed, and none of it has been reviewed yet, and then to run the code inside that blob of data and then give you some results. And so fundamentally, the challenge of securing that is pretty tough. And so I think it's an area that's going to see a lot of cool development in the next few years as like vendors start building in more security features into their CI systems, or teams start thinking more about like, okay, what is our chain of trust here exactly? But yeah, that's a tricky one, because you want to make sure that there are a number of security controls before somebody can push something to your CI. But once that happens, it can be hard to defend. And especially if you maintain an open source project, like we've seen a lot of open source projects that have a big problem with this because they have an even harder problem. They want to accept code from anyone. They've got a system that runs code as a service, and then also they need some way to like securely find all artifacts. It's a tough one.
Yeah, and I think it reminds me of a thing, because I think I was having a conversation with someone about the logs being generated by a CI system and open source tool again. None of the secrets were being, I guess, masked. And you almost see the logs. You can see the passwords or secrets going through it. I could see the AWS session token going. I'm going, this is not... Like, so technically, I don't even have to access my CI/CD system. I just need to have access to my logs, and I can basically recreate the thing. I can see the person's credential there, and sometimes PII. I mean, yeah, there's so much depth to it. But yeah, as an organization, some people may choose, I don't really worry about this. So deep in my network, no one reach it. Yeah, sure, whatever,
yeah,
man.
Yeah. That's... Yeah, well, I mean, I think it would be cool to be able to get these systems to the point where it's like the CI system has so few permissions that it's fine if everything is totally in the clear, because that's the place where you want developers to be able to be really free in how they do stuff.
Right.
Like you want that to be the high velocity point where they can run whatever tests and not get in the way of like bogged down security reviews. I think the really challenging part is then, okay, once you have like run your tests, how do you then run some more verified tests and do a build that is like off of good reviewed code or things that have gone through your static analysis or whatever like that. So I think that'll be something that will be cool to see as people build more paradigm.
Yeah, because it's so common, almost like to your point, no one questions the, I guess, the legitimacy of how are you really protecting the CI/CD pipeline? Because I remember for a long time, and this is probably the last point, I would start talking about this after this, that Jenkins didn't even have like a login page. It was for so long. It took so long to build a login page. And you think, hey, this is a CI/CD server, to your point, which has access keys to, which probably are admin access keys as well, into an environment. It allows you to just change the code. So, all right, I'm going to stop my rant there, but very different path. Talking about DevOps pipelines and applications, maybe it's a good segue into the project that you did and presented on. I'd love for my audience to kind of hear the thinking behind it and how you kind of build the zero trust principles in the application that you...
Yeah, so specifically with this project, and I won't go into the full depth because there's a blog post and a talk you can watch if you want to. But basically, we had a number of internal web applications at Figma. And in my experience, all companies have some of these, right? And then we knew that as our company was growing, they were just going to be... And we wanted to make it so that it wasn't going to be a huge lift for engineers who want to build an internal application to do something, whether or not it's deploying the site or viewing some internal documentation or like interacting with a development server or something like that. We wanted to make sure that engineers were empowered to easily spin these things up with security properties that we were comfortable with. And the previous model that had been used was involved like these client certs that were required to access these apps. And like that worked pretty well. Like that's kind of hard to fish a TLS cert, but it was really a pain on the operation side because like distributing the cert was hard and like browsers are not always good at handling client certs. And it was kind of a mess. And so the idea was, how can we use these modern features of cloud providers like AWS and our SSO provider Okta and everything so that we can kind of present this interface to engineers saying like, use this Terraform config to set up access to your app, and then you will immediately get login with our SSO and multi-factor authentication and device trust and like a bunch of other little things on top of that. And so, yeah, the foundations of the solution are built with AWS ALDs. It connects through Cognito to use SAML with Okta. That was a little bit of an interesting like AWS quirk. Basically, like ALBs do OIDC authentication. Okta actually does support direct OIDC, but we ended up using Cognito as a sort of middle service there, which has been kind of helpful because it means that we can kind of plug in arbitrary auth backends to that. And so if we want to have an application that's like employees plus some other people, you can kind of add them in at the Cognito layer, which is like kind of a neat trick. So that was kind of how we set up that auth end flow. And then we were able to utilize some of Okta's features to build really strong security policies that we feel gives our apps a ton of phish resistance and a really good visibility into what people are logging into and accessing and that sort of thing. The other area that we were able to utilize here is like the ALBs can provide a sort of centralized logging. That was very helpful. And then sort of cherry on top that we were able to add, which I was pretty happy with, is that we built this system for accessing these internal web apps, but it wasn't long before someone said like, well, what if I build an API that I want to be internal and it wouldn't be accessed through a browser, it's like for a CLI tool or something else, like how would we make that work? And at first it's kind of tricky because if you want to add a lot of advanced authent features, like how do you do web authent to a CLI tool that's then going to make API requests? Like that's pretty hard. But we were able to come up with a solution using a serverless function, a Lambda, that was able to sort of implement CLI auth capability or this API access capability for all of these services sort of at once. It was like a really good validation of, okay, if you can build these sort of centralized components that are reusable and somebody can just like flip a flag in their Terraform and then suddenly this Lambda gets deployed and it allows them to do this sort of CLI auth to their app. So yeah, the motivations were really to make the act of spinning up a new service and exposing it to engineers or employees in general not a horrible process. It's something that like maybe security would be vaguely involved in that we'd like give some advice, but it shouldn't be like, oh, I have to spend a week doing this thing. It should be, I'm going to go take this Terraform config and I'm going to change the name to my app's name and then apply that. And then cool, my app is on the internet now. And at the same time, we can have all these controls around it about who can log in and that sort of thing. Like I mentioned before, the sort of representation of user identity down to the underlying service is really important there. And so fortunately, the ALB plus Cognito plus Okta flow does allow you to send a lot of information down in signed JWTs. And so the underlying applications can see signed information about who is accessing them. and make decisions based on that. So we use that for permissions in a bunch of places.
Oh, okay. And I'll do is also link the talk in, because this was a talk at Forward Cloud 6. So I'll definitely encourage people to read the blog post as well as the whole talk.
I guess I just ran through a 30-minute talk in 5 minutes.
I appreciate that, because I think it'll be it's probably not fair for me to kind of explain the whole talk in just a 30-minute talk into like 5 minutes, or even not even 5 minutes. But I think the few things that I took away from it, which I thought would be really interesting, were obviously some of the components we've already spoken about in this episode so far, where it's about, I guess, the underlying principles and how do you want to implement them. Something else as well, because maybe after this, people get pumped, they read the blog, they watch the talk that you gave at Forward CloudSec. And one of the things that people would, I guess, think about is, hey, how do I start building this in my team? And I'm curious to know about the initial thought process that you had, like what kind of like things people could be looking for, what kind of skill set should they be thinking about as well in their team? Like, could be a team leader or tech leader or a CISO here thinking, actually, we should do that, because I've always thought about implementing a zero trust principle. Like, what kind of skill set are we thinking?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I remember from sort of the beginnings of this project was sort of a consistent push to see, like, could we make this part better? And we thought about that a lot from a user experience perspective, as well as a security one. So there was a lot of early design iteration where it's like, well, right now, as it's currently configured, like, the user has to click this button to continue the offload. Like, can we get rid of that button? Can we make it as seamless as possible? Can we make it so that people don't realize authentication is happening? And that's actually been like a fun thing that we've noticed in a few cases, is that there were a few cases where we set this up. It was pretty seamless. At one point, people were surprised because they log in because they had like a non-device trusted thing, and they had not actually realized that auth was ever enabled on this service. It was just totally transparent to them, and they're like, oh, I knew there was an auth there. So that was kind of a cool validation of some of the user experience work we did. So first off, like, what do you need in a team? Do a lot of mock-ups and tests and try to keep thinking about, like, how can we make this more pleasant to use? Because that's how you're going to get adoption, right? You can build a cool, secure platform, but if people don't want to use it or it's too hard to integrate with, it's not going to provide you a lot of security value. The other thing that I'll note, which is just sort of a fact of the design here, like, a lot of what we were trying to do was use these core infrastructure components that come from things like our cloud provider or our SSO provider and connect those up so that we didn't have to build a lot of our custom code, right? We're a small security team. We've got a lot of stuff to do. We can't spend all day like keeping the site up, basically. So a lot of what we're thinking about is, how do we connect these various components that weren't written by us? But another impact of that is that when you're trying to combine various components from multiple different technology providers, you're going to run into some interesting bugs. There's going to be some incompatibilities. You might need to like try a lot of configurations, dive deep into undocumented Terraform options, like all that sort of stuff. And so there's a fair amount of, I guess you could say, like, resilience or willingness to like just keep trying stuff and tweak it until it works nicely. There's somebody who I knew who kind of described a particular class of technologists as sort of the tinkerer, which is people who can take a system and then attach a new thing and figure out how to get those things to work together and tweak this and like customize that and like just keep iterating until you get a really nice product. And I think that was the sort of spirit that made this project. We had high goals for ourselves from the beginning about how it was going to be to use and the security properties we were going to get from it. And then we just kind of kept iterating until it got better and better. Something that is not immediately clear from like the blog post or the talk or stuff. It kind of seems like it was all one project. This was work that was done over a period of about 9 months as we like built an MVP that did the authentication. And then we realized like, oh, we could add on this. Or like, oh, we can now do better stuff with JWTs here. And like, as we learn more about the platform and learn more about the use case that we were trying to fulfill, we're able to make it better and better. So it kind of gets presented as like, oh, we built all of this right out of the gate. And that's not really how it works. And I suspect that's not really how any products work, right? You build what people need from the beginning. And then as you understand that use case better, you add on and on and make it better.
Yeah. And I think Kapil mentioned it correctly. Skill set in itself can be another podcast, because like we can talk, go down a very different rabbit hole at that point. I'm actually thinking, like, say someone who gets inspired by this talk and starts building on applications with zero trust principles, does the security, like, there, because you come from a pen testing background as well, and obviously there's offensive pieces, like we spoke about the cookie replay as well. From a defense point of view, with an application built on the zero trust principle, does that change dramatically how would you defend it, or it becomes easier? Like, what were the thoughts around that?
Yeah, there's things that get easier and some things that get harder. If you're at the point where you believe an incident has already happened and you're trying to investigate, I think that's where you actually get a lot of the gains of this system, is that you have some logs from a service that you think are incorrect. And like that service had more information about who was accessed than it would have otherwise, right? Because gone are the days where it's like, oh, well, this service was hacked by 10.9.3.42. Who knows who had that IP 2 weeks ago, right? I've seen very few systems that keep like a really good track of like all historical IPs and their assignments over a long period of time. Anyway, you would have more information. You're like, oh, well, there's a suspicious request, but like, here's the user that sent it. And we're like pretty sure that it was in fact that user. Other things like source IP address is now a much more meaningful indicator than it was previously, because now, you know, especially in a COVID work from home environment, like we can actually build a pretty good profile of employees and where they connect to our systems from, right? A lot of people are working from home, and so we kind of know what their home IP address is. And so suddenly when we see a new IP that's totally outside of that, I mean, sure, they might have gone on vacation or gone to a coffee shop, but that is another signal that we can use to build a better picture of what might have happened during a security event. I think a lot of that investigation can kind of get easier because you're enriching more information about what was going on at the time more throughout the stack, and you don't have to do these sort of tricky correlations of like, okay, well, my VPN server had these logs. I think it gave out this IP address to that user, and then I see this IP address later. Like, you don't necessarily have to do as much of that hop stuff, and you also don't have to think about like, oh, is 802.1x working in my office? Like, are our Ethernet ports secure? You can kind of like get rid of that whole can of worms. I will say though that from a defense perspective, ruling this out is tricky, because as you are going from this model of like everything kind of had this protective shell around it because it was on the internal network, and you're bringing things out, you have to be pretty meticulous about understanding what your attack surface is and making sure that everything is ready for that new prime time of like being on the internet totally. Right. There are misconfigurations you could end up introducing in your rollout here that might expose certain paths even to unauthenticated users, or might skip certain authentication requirements in certain cases. So you have to have a really good understanding of like, how sure are you when you deploy a system in this model that all of your guarantees are being enforced? Something that we've been able to have a lot of success with there is, even when we add a rule that says MFA is required for the service, adding alerts for even cases we think should be impossible. And that's been very productive. It's like, okay, well, even though the Okta rule says you must have WebAuthn under all circumstances, we're still going to write alert rule for somebody logs in without WebAuthn, because then clearly our assumptions, our invariants are incorrect. And we need to go back and revisit those or understand what was missing in that rollout. And so that's really been a strategy we've used, is this sort of combination of configuration, but also alerting and high signal, high priority alerts for things that we think should be impossible. And those are really good at pulling out things, misconfigurations, or places where you missed something, things like that. So I'm not going to lie, there's a lot of challenge here on the front end of like, as you're going to this model and as you are taking that 12-year-old PHP web app that is really important and you want to like go put it on the internet as opposed to this internal thing, I think it's going to get more secure, but you're going to have to acknowledge that it might be a little bit of a challenging road to be confident in that deployment.
Fair enough. Now, I think it actually explains quite a bit as well. Although there might be a bit added complexity, but there are definitely some benefits as well.
Yeah. It actually also briefly touches on something that I had not really appreciated before I was doing this work, is that writing good alerts can actually, it's not purely a reactive thing. It can actually help you build a better system. And I think sometimes detection and response is sort of pushed off into this other function of like, oh, we write alerts and then those people off in their office, they look at them and they like deal with them appropriately. But I think it's a feedback loop that really should be involving the people who built the system as well. It's really like DevOps all over again, right? Yeah. If you are implementing a system, you write some alerts and you see what those alerts say, and then you like learn more about the system that you just built.
That is true, because you're the one who's building it. Kind of like the way the QA testing kind of disappeared in the development land. The developers are now expected to do QA testing. There's no separate QA person. So similar to that, I imagine this is the same concept. Right. You're building it. You probably know what the negative test is as well.
Yeah. And also, it encourages you not to write flaky or like inconsistent security alerts, right? Because if you've ever done that detection response role, like those are the worst, when you have like 300 alerts and you just know that probably 299 of them don't make any sense or like aren't necessary. It's important to make sure that everyone throughout the stack of writing that alert and building that system is sort of held accountable for that, and that the actual security signals that you end up acting on are really high quality ones.
Yep. Yeah. No, fair enough. I appreciate that. I think it's a good one to kind of, well, I was going to say, that was kind of my last question as well, but what I'm going to do is, for people who are kind of jumping in, these guys are going into way deep into the application security territory. So I'm going to pop some videos around later on after the stream for people to kind of refresh application security and threat detection. So this is kind of like the final section, and it's just basically fun questions, man. There are three questions, not two. It's just for people to get to know you a bit. And the first question is, what do you spend most time on when you're not working on technology or cloud or zero trust?
Yeah, so something that I am really passionate about is tabletop role-playing games and collaborative fiction. So I've played D&D for a long time, but I've recently been really enjoying the indie role-playing game space. And so I spend a lot of time designing and inventing worlds and then inviting my friends over on a Zoom call to go play through those and like build interesting stories together. So that's something that I really love doing. Yeah.
Well, I'm quite in depth. Like, do you guys dress up as well?
We generally do not dress up. It's just words. But yes, that also seems fun. And if I were better at the sewing machine, then perhaps I could get into that.
Fair enough. No, I think it'll be really interesting to have a story play out and see where it lands. But cool. That's a great answer, man. The next question, what is something that you're proud of but is not on your social media?
Well, I think this is kind of a recent one, but I have been trying to start the journey of becoming a plant dad. So when I moved during the pandemic, I got a place that had a little bit more natural light. And I was like, maybe I can replace all of these garbage IKEA plastic plants with like real ones that are alive and try and make my living space a little bit more pleasant. I really like spending time outside as well. So I wanted to bring some of the outside in. And so I think that I've been able to make some gains on some very healthy house plants and some nice window boxes. And it gives me some joy, but not on my social media, because anywhere near the level of many other people. It's just sort of like a personal pride that I'm like, oh, I grew up.
Yeah, fair enough. I tried being a plant dad, but it did not work out. I killed like three plants after that. You're like, nah, I don't want to kill anymore. So it's definitely a journey. So good luck with that. And I'll definitely maybe take some tips from you once you're done with that. One more final question. What's your favorite cuisine or restaurant?
My favorite cuisine, technically cuisine, but I just love burritos. I'm from San Francisco Bay Area. The Mission burrito is very close to my heart. And my favorite Mission burrito is of those from La Tac, which is at 25th and Mission, I think. So if you're ever in San Francisco, that's the place to go. It's cash only, big line, but it's totally worth it. Yeah, it's a fantastic burrito.
Oh, I feel like burrito is another one, which is like, they kept trying to make it so, how can you make it different? That like, there's so many varieties of burrito as well. I think, I don't know if you guys have this, but we have this something called a deconstructed burrito, but you're kind of making your own burrito, which is the entire thing is in your bowl. But I just wanted a burrito.
Well, the thing that I often joke about here is I like to think that I have taste, but not standards. So I can identify when a burrito is really good, but even if it's like a $2 frozen thing, I'll still enjoy it.
Yeah. But this is really awesome conversation, man. Thanks so much for coming in. Absolutely. And where can people find you if they want to connect with you?
I'm on Twitter at MaxB. And yeah, I think that's probably the easiest way to get in touch with me, or MaxB.fm is my website.
Awesome. All right. I'll put those in the show notes as well. But thanks so much for coming in. Well, thanks for coming in with us, man. For everyone else, I will see you next weekend. This was the last episode for the Cloud Security Trends Month. We're going to go into another month of, we're actually talking about serverless next month. So that'll be kind of interesting. Awesome. Thanks so much for coming in, everyone. Talk to you soon. Peace.
If you have been enjoying your weekly cloud security news, search for Cloud Security News on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe. Leave us a review if you are loving what we're doing, and do share it with someone who you think will get value from this. This has been your Cloud Security News for this week. Thank you for listening.